gave you some questions.
All right, it's now recording.
Okay.
Yeah, we got some questions too, and
we'll get to that.
Yeah, so.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm Ray Rudolph.
Uh-huh.
And I lived in San Francisco for 42 years.
42
come
years.
April 1st, I arrived April 1st, 1976.
Mm-hmm.
I was born in New York City,
uh-huh.
1950, and I grew up and came out on the streets of Manhattan.
Wait, so what exactly was it that like made you realize you were gay?
Interesting. I always knew inside that, you know, I gravitated towards men. I found men interesting. I always had a lot of women friends, and my best friend in the world is still a straight woman. So that was, there was never a conflict of I need to be gay or straight. I blended in high school. I knew my best friends were the captains of the football team, but mm-hmm. I also knew the Greasers, and I was president of the drama club and all of that.
You knew everybody. You had a hand in every pie.
I did, and I liked that. And that's what made me think that I was not gay, because I couldn't define gay. It was homosexual.
There wasn't terminology for that?
No, homosexual.
That you weren't aware of?
It was until, as I mentioned earlier, it was mm-hmm. December 15th of 1973 was when the American Psychiatric Association took the word homosexuality off its list of psychiatric disorders.
Yes.
And I was 19 when Stonewall happened, and I was home for the summer from Syracuse University, where I was going to school. And I had been out since I was probably 12 or something, mm-hmm. 13, certainly junior high school. I remember pestering my parents to take me to see a Broadway show. Hello, Dolly, with Carol Channing, St. James Theater, 1964. I was 14. Mm-hmm. And we're sitting in the orchestra, and I'm watching these guys dancing and leaping around the stage, and I'm connecting with them. That was one of the first things where I said, okay, there's things outside of me. There's some kind of community out there. There's other people like me out there.
Yeah.
So from that time on, 1964, I saw everything that was on Broadway. I did. I saw, you know, Barbara Streisand and Funny Girl. I saw everything that was on Broadway and off Broadway, because what I would do is I would follow the chorus boys.
Yeah.
And I would see where they were going. And they would go to places like Joe Allen or Brothers and Sisters on West 46th Street, mm-hmm. Between matinees. And I would watch them. And when I would see one guy touch another guy, I just got all excited. And then I discovered, this is, again, 1964-65, Screw Magazine. Okay, Screw
okay.
Magazine was a tabloid.
Uh-huh.
I don't know whether you
heard I've done a little bit of research on, like, different, like, gay magazines. Like, a little bit.
Well, at the time, After Dark Magazine was mm-hmm. the more mainstream, very subtext, subtly gay. With the photographs, and so we could read that, and we could actually, I redesigned that for my master's program in Northwestern. I redesigned that magazine,
mm-hmm.
made it even more gay. But Screw
That's
Magazine,
a great improvement.
It was,
yeah, that's a good improvement.
Yeah,
I
thought
that.
So.
It's an upgrade.
Well, Screw Magazine was basically straight,
uh-huh.
and there was a lot of, you know, women's bosoms on the front,
uh-huh.
but in the very last page, in the very bottom, it was men seeking men.
Oh.
And I said, oh. The light bulb goes on here. And, ooh, what does it mean for a man to massage another man? Or what is this? What is this about?
What is
you know?
This about?
Yeah, you know, what are they advertising? What is this? So on my one of my, you know, many four-ways in New York, I would follow people. And so I followed guys down to the Village.
Mm-hmm.
And I found some gay bars. And I found the Trucks, and I found some other places.
What age were you at that time when you found these gay bars?
Yeah, I was about 16,
so
17.
You were,
I couldn't get in.
You
but
couldn't
I,
get into
I
the
could
bars,
hang around.
But you saw the bars.
I knew where they were. Julius's on West, I think it was West 14th Street, was one of my first.
Uh-huh.
By the time I was 17, I saw Judy Garland in person,
uh-huh.
which was very interesting because I did have a gay friend in high school. Again,
mm-hmm.
we couldn't define ourselves as gay because we knew we liked
but
men.
But you knew they were kind the, your friend was kind of like you.
Oh, yeah.
You knew that.
He had a very eclectic family. He had an auntie Mame, and they were a very progressive family. They were from Canada, actually. But they lived...
It's always the Canadians.
I know. And so his father got us tickets to see Judy Garland in person at 17, okay? Mm-hmm. That was the first time that I was in the company of so many other gay men and boys.
That's always such a weird experience.
It was.
Being around a lot of gay people for the first time.
It was exhilarating.
You're just kind of shell-shocked when it happens. You're
indeed.
Like, what? What's
so you know
on?
A little bit about Judy Garland and her relationship to Stonewall, and that was the catalyst for Stonewall, her death. But seeing her at 17, I mean, even now, if I can close my eyes, I can remember... Mm-hmm. This was 2 years before she died, so she was at the end of her, you know, she was kind of a little off, and she would miss notes, and the guys in the audience would go, take your time, Judy, we love you,
we love
and they
you.
Clap, and
so
I was seeing this
wrong.
Gay interaction, this gay wave kind of happening there, and I felt a part of it, and I don't think I was ever the same after that particular night.
Uh-huh.
I remember also seeing Barbara Streisand in Funny Girl, 1966, at the Winter Garden Theater, and we were sitting in box seats, my friend Bobby and I, and we were looking down. She was singing People up to us on the pit, not directly to us, but look, and we knew that we were seeing a major diva rising. You know, nobody else.
You knew that she was going to be going.
We
places,
knew.
But she hadn't gone places yet. But she,
no.
Wow.
Same thing with Bette Midler. I saw Bette Midler at the Continental Baths, which is a story that.
That's a story in itself.
That was a little bit later. That was around 1971 or something.
Uh-huh.
But again, I got to see her at the very beginning of her career. Before nobody in New York, besides New York, knew who she was. So what they were doing is... she was performing in Fiddler on the Roof on Broadway.
Uh-huh.
And then after hours, Streisand would go to the Village and she would go to kind of, they would do their own cabaret act.
Okay.
And that's how it was discovered. So the New York Times wrote about Bette Midler in the entertainment section, and all of a sudden the baths were pretty tacky. So you'd have the basement and you'd have the pool and you'd have guys sitting in towels, and then all of a sudden, because of the New York Times, well dressed in suits and tuxes and gowns, that people would come up, you know, to see her, and that's how she developed her career with Bathhouse Betty. So I was kind of in the right place at the right time to be what I consider a participant observer of all of this happening in New York, and I was exposed to diversity, and I don't know what it was inside of me, but I could understand at some level, okay, the hustlers outside of Port Authority or whatever. I got a feel for what there was another kind of community there. I just didn't know how I
there
fit in.
There was an underground community.
Underground for sure.
And you felt like you felt a sort of affinity with them, kind of?
I felt a connection, an undefined connection. And I was, when I'm jumping ahead just a little bit
now. That's okay.
Okay. and stop me any time. But when I went to Chicago for my Northwestern to get my master's degree in journalism, 1972 to 1973, a whole new world opened up to me in Chicago, because I was kind of away from home for the first time.
And
you know,
you
mom
said that
and dad.
You made a lot of gay friends.
And I did. I made gay friends at Syracuse. I mean, there were gay people starting to become visible after 1969. Not before that. When I was in high school, it was pretty under wraps. And I never hid who I was.
Mm-hmm.
I choreographed all the shows in the drama department.
Yeah.
You know, I did all of that. But I also, you know, knew the cheerleaders and the football team. Mm-hmm. I had no problem with that.
Yeah.
Because to me, even now, being gay means being all-inclusive, being kind of collective, embracing changes and difference. And I never saw myself as fitting into one mode. Okay, this is who I am, and this is what I'm supposed to do to be that. So when I went to Northwestern, after I graduated from Northwestern, in my graduating class, they told us, they said, okay, everybody, you need to go out to a small town newspaper and get your experience and work your way up. This is in journalism.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I said, well, wait a minute now. It's 1972, 1973. I've been out to myself since I was 14, 15 on the streets of New York. I'm used to New York and Chicago. I am not going to Duluth. I am not going to some small town now. What was most important to me then was defining who I was as a gay person, as a mm-hmm. gay man, and finding a community.
Yeah.
And there was, starting in Chicago, and certainly New York by then. So I was very excited. So I said, no, I turned down a job in Dallas with mm-hmm. Dallas Civic Ballet. I also turned down a job in Cincinnati. Now, Dallas and Cincinnati are good-sized
nice
cities,
places, but, they don't
but not at that time for a gay person. So I was preparing to go back to New York, and a friend of mine had come out to San Francisco.
And that's what brought you
And that's
San
what brought
Francisco.
Me here. Sight
that's
unseen.
That's one of the things that I'm interested in. And, like, everybody always has all these different stories about, like, how they ended up here.
Yeah.
And some of the people kind of just stumbled upon the gay scene. And
I didn't stumble upon it.
I picked that up.
I was actually ready to, you know, kick it into gear a little bit.
Yeah,
and
you knew what
Well, I wanted to build upon what I thought I knew at the
yeah.
time and what I felt I knew. Mm-hmm. A certain sexuality at that time was a currency that we gay men, I will speak for, shared in terms of building community and how we got to know each other. Of course,
mm-hmm.
that all changed in the 80s with AIDS, which
we'll
get to in a second. But at the time, I was building upon what I felt instinctively inside of me.
Mm-hmm.
And I never thought being gay was wrong or bad or sinful or any of that. My parents weren't particularly religious or anything, so I didn't have to grow up Catholic. I didn't have to deal with that. I had pretty good parents. They came around, you know, my mother would always say, you know, later on in life, well, when are you going to give me a grandkid? I said, Ma, you know the answer to that. And she goes, yeah, I know. And she was fine. She really was very cool with it all.
I gave my mom a plant.
Did you?
She calls it her grand plant.
Grand plant. I should have done that.
I'm like, Ma, have you killed the grand plant yet? And
the
she's like, nope, it's still alive.
Oh.
Like, oh, good job, Mom.
Well, that's wonderful. I'm hoping that my generation set the tone. Other generations to come along and feel, because my generation, I always now define myself in retrospect as being a member of the first post-Stonewall and the last pre-age generation.
Yeah.
So if you came of age as a gay man, I'll speak for that, from 1969, when I was 19 in New York, to 84, when AIDS really hit, and I was 34 then. If you came of age during that time period, it was the most fabulous time in the world.
Mm-hmm.
It was building communities, and yes, there was sex and drugs and disco and all of that, but
there was also this huge community building going
creativity.
On. Creativity.
Yeah. Gay bars were the first businesses, but then there were all kinds of gay businesses starting,
uh-huh.
and the BAR and the gay press, and just so much was happening that pretty much got shut down in the 80s with AIDS, but...
Yeah.
From the time I arrived, in 2 weeks, like I say, I'll be celebrating my 42nd year here,
mm-hmm.
and to the time when AIDS hit, that was a wonderfully creative time here, and in New York and L.A. and other places, it was starting to happen, but San Francisco specifically.
Yeah.
Of course, then it was a smaller town. I remember when I first arrived in 76. I was horrified because there wasn't a subway.
Oh.
I said, but they were building it. They were building
uh-huh.
it. But it wasn't open yet. And half of downtown wasn't here and all the buildings and stuff that you see now. So it was definitely a smaller community.
Uh-huh.
And it was easier at that time. This is before social media and technology
mm-hmm.
and all of that. I can't even, I sort of understand, but I can't even imagine how guys now, they're on Grindr or Growl or however that works. You know? But not my gen, not me. So... We went through, when the 80s came, we lost so many. And overnight, we went from light to dark,
mm-hmm.
from creativity and promise to heartache and despair and depression. And the gay men were falling. I lost everybody who came out from Chicago after us, gone.
Yeah.
I went to memorial services every week. We'd be checking to see if we have lesions. There was so much misinformation coming out about AIDS. The government wasn't doing anything. The city was trying to figure out, do we close the bathhouses? What do we do? What do we do? So the gay community had to do it for themselves.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I and some of my friends did is we brought, it was a holistic practitioner named Louise Hay
mm-hmm.
in L.A., Los Angeles. She was the only one that was doing anything with AIDS at this time. Mm-hmm. And we brought her up here for a series of seminars and healing sessions at Fort Mason. I did the press releases, and it was well attended by hundreds of gay men. Mm-hmm. And so we were trying to, and that's when the lesbians just stepped out of the woodwork. They were always here. They were always in the background.
And,
5 minutes.
Oh, man.
So am I talking too much?
Oh, no. I've heard that, like, the lesbian community and the gay community did not really interact.
They didn't.
Much at all.
No. The Castro was gay white men.
Uh-huh.
With our shirts off, the Castro clone. We had boots, jeans, flannel shirts, and mustaches.
Did you look like that?
I still look like that.
You still look like that.
Well, in my head, anyway. Yeah. No, I have pictures to prove it. No, we were all, we were called the Castro clones.
Yeah.
And we'd meet on Castro and 18th Street. And that's how information was exchanged and community was built. And oh, this is happening and that's happening. The lesbians had Maud's Bar and a couple of bars. And they were always here. But they didn't hang out on the Castro. That time was Polk Street.
Mm-hmm.
But when the gay men could not do it for themselves. I mean, this, I can't even describe how decimated this community was for those 10 years. We lost so many good people, and I'm still grieving to see if those people had still been alive now, how different this, our community would be.
Because it was just taking off.
It was just beginning.
It was
beginning. These people were giving all of their creative juices to it, and then it just ended overnight. And as I told you, I'm a long-term AIDS survivor.
Yeah.
And I'm just one of the lucky ones because I didn't serial convert until after protease inhibitors came in.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember talking to, I'm going all over the map Joan Rivers was a friend of mine, if you know Joan Rivers. And I was backstage with her one time. She was doing a performance.
Mm-hmm.
And she was the first person to do an AIDS benefit in Los Angeles. And, and she tried to get her celebrity friends to do, nobody would come.
They wouldn't do it.
Everybody was so afraid of AIDS because then it was a gay disease and all this other stuff. So the lesbians came, they took up fundraising. They bought meals to hospitals where nurses didn't want to go into the wards.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, lesbians became, and now they're very prominent in the city. And I think they did, they had their thing, and the gay guys had their thing. And I knew a few transgender people at that time, but, they were way in the shadows because, we were still building a community, and the city at large, or the country at large, or the communities at large, had a slow process in accepting us.
Well, I don't think any of these things ever just happen in like leaps and bounds. It's what we expect, but they take time.
And then we had to fight Anita Bryant and the Briggs Initiative. She wanted to, gay teachers can't be teaching school. And
you were involved in that?
We protested, we marched, we canvassed. Same thing for Harvey Milk to get him elected as supervisor. And that was a bit, and then the White Knight riot. So that was a whole other thing, which, I won't even go into. That's, the city just erupted that night.
Yeah.
And I remember when the verdict came down, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I do know what you're talking about. Were you out on the night of the White Knight?
Oh, hell yes.
Yeah?
First of all, prior to that, we had the candlelight march down Market Street for when Harvey died.
Yes.
And it was just so, it still brings tears to my eyes to think about that night. to see all those people marching down silently with candles to City Hall. Well, then, that was in, I think it was November, when he, 78, when they were assassinated.
Yes.
And then in, I think it was May or something, the verdict came down for Dan White, the Tweaky defense.
Yeah.
And he got off. Well, everybody just congregated at the Castro.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, again, before social media.
We just knew to
go.
It. Yeah.
And thousands of people, angry, yelling. We marched down Market Street. I don't want to say that I personally broke windows, or I didn't, or set police cars on fire, but I saw that all happening. And I was for it. I was saying, okay, enough. This is wrong. I'm digressing for a moment here, but kind of what I'm feeling now with Trump, living in Trump land, but this is wrong.
Yeah, I know.
And it just brings up the anger. But that night was horrific in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody in the city slept that night. And, he ended up committing suicide after that, and it's now all history. But to live through all of those times, starting on the streets of Manhattan in the 60s, trying to figure out long before Stonewall, who am I and how do I fit in? I know I'm different. I know what I like, but what does it mean? And then traveling through Chicago and then out to San Francisco, sight unseen when I came out here. I'd never been here before, never even considered California.
Yeah.
And but when I came out here and I got involved and I felt all of this energy of building communities, and I started working in a gay bar here, and I saw all these people had different ideas. I worked with Bob Ross. He was a chef at the PS restaurant, and this building is named after him.
It's named after him.
So
there's a plaque out there.
There's a plaque out there, and it should be, and I remember. So I just tapped into that energy, and I felt it a little bit more in New York when I was younger, but I didn't know what to do with it. Now in San Francisco, I really felt it. And I said, absolutely, I'm here.
Yeah.
So here I am.
Oh, wow. All right, I'm just going to give you the quick rundown on who I am.
Please do.
So most of the students here are from MCLA, but I'm from Mount Holyoke College.
Okay, I know that.
Do you know Mount Holyoke College?
I do.
So it's a women's college,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
And it's funny. I wasn't out of the closet when I was in high school, but I did know I was gay. And I didn't actually think about the fact that I was going to a women's college when I was applying to it.
That you'd be around all these other women.
I'd be all around all these other women. And I was like, oh, this place is just so supportive and educational. And I got there, and it seemed like everybody, there's a huge gay community at my college. And, like, you can't go 5 seconds without seeing a gay person.
Was that surprising to you?
It was. It was surprising. It was like that moment where you're surrounded by all these people kind of like you. And you're like, whoa. Because it's one thing to be surrounded by gay people. But it's one thing to be surrounded by, like, lesbians, basically, for me. Because, like, for instance, if I'm walking around here and I don't, you know, I relate to gay men, but like there's different experiences, right? So and one of the things I've noticed walking around here is I've never seen this many gay men in my life. Because like I grew up in the Northampton area.
Uh-huh.
I go to Mount Holyoke. Those are two very women, lesbian centric areas. So it was just, it kind of blew me out of the water, but it's a really neat place. Yeah.
Two of my closest friends in Chicago, I'm going to use an incorrect term,
ahead,
I'm sure, a lipstick lesbian, Rose and Nancy, they were my buddies. I have known what I'm saying. I've been fortunate to know many very good lesbians. I don't, you know, and I'm so thankful that they were there for all of us in the 80s, but I've always had wonderful lesbian friends, and I never had a problem, appreciating a woman or anything like that. And so I think it was a really good thing. If any good things could come out of something like AIDS, it was the fact that our communities became more integrated and more understanding of each other, which I don't know, it would have eventually evolved that way, I think, but I don't know. At the time we were, you know, there was the men, and there was the lesbians, and there was transgender, and there was the other ones that didn't fit in, the questioning. There was all this fraction, sort of. So tell me more. What are issues that concern you today?
The thing is, I'm just so... There's just so much to record. Okay.
Well, I am interested in the younger generation, as it were. I hope you don't mind being called the younger generation.
Yeah, I am young and figuring things out, barely know what's going on. And, right now, I it almost feels a little, I guess this has to do with adultism. It almost feels a little childish, but, like, I'm trying to figure out what the heck I'm going to do with my life. Like, you know, I'm in college. I'm a history major and a religion minor. And, like, I'm trying to figure out how the heck am I going to find a job with these majors. Actually, it's not that bad looking at the moment.
Do you want to teach or...?
I'd like to go into museum work and working in archives. And I'm actually looking into volunteering at the GLBT.
Historical Society?
Yeah,
oh, good. Oh, yeah, you should.
Because these are, like, something I'm really interested in is preserving these histories.
Thank you.
Because, I mean, that's really cool to me. And so the way that I got into this class, there's a class at MCLA that's focused on queer history or gay history in San Francisco. And I found out about this in the travel opportunity from my uncle who works at MCLA.
Ah.
And I basically went to one of my teachers. I was like, I want to do an independent study.
about this. So I'm loosely basing my syllabus around Sumi's syllabus and...
You have to create your path, your own way.
The reason I say loosely is because I went all over the place and, like, my education in this is... It has some holes, but I feel like I just keep learning more and more. There's just so much. And
follow your instincts. I don't want to put any advice out there, but I look back, and I had a good career and good life and everything, but I kind of go, oh, okay. I kind of look around and I go, if I had not been driven to explore my gay identity, mm-hmm. for lack of a better term, that took me to San Francisco and prevented me from taking a job in Cincinnati after graduate school, all of that. I look back now at this point in my life, I'm about to turn 68, and I look back and I really want the younger generation to have the positive experiences that I did. It wasn't all positive, there's a lot of challenges, a lot of struggle, but there's more information out there now than when I was coming up.
Yeah.
So make use of that in any way that your instincts lead you, as the Historical Society, come spend more time in San Francisco, whatever.
Yeah. I mean, this is just such a unique place, and history in the gay community that developed around here is so different than everywhere else, and it's just the things that... It's crazy to me. It's so crazy. But
now, in the day, when I say in the day,
back in the 70s.
but the point is, the Castro now is not a gay neighborhood. It's a gay-themed neighborhood.
It's been kind of... It's touristy now.
Yeah, the Village in New York is not a gay neighborhood. It's a gay-themed neighborhood. Mm-hmm. That is not... I'm not saying that's... bad. It's just it's not what I would prefer.
It's not the same.
Because it changed in the 80s. Literally, Castro Street shut down, and it became reimagined as other shopkeepers came in and whatnot. And now tourists, and they hear the gay history and they want to go there. And there's a walk of fame if you've gone down Castro Street and you see the plaques in the street.
Oh yeah, I saw those.
All of that, which is lovely, and it's good to do that. But the idea of community, needs to be preserved. Now, we're all mainstream. We don't need to have those gay ghettos that we created. We created, my generation created these gay ghettos, especially in large cities, now they're everywhere, because we're mainstream. And there's gay families, and gay people live in the suburbs, and it's all over, but not back then. They were in the closet if they did.
Yeah.
But they came to places like San Francisco or New York or LA to not be constricted in their creativity and their sense of wanting to build community. So now we don't have those neighborhoods as they once were, but we don't necessarily need them. Mm-hmm. But I don't want the younger generation to lose track of what those communities meant.
Well, that's one of the things I'm thinking about as I get older, because I want to live in a place where there are a lot of gay people.
A lot here.
And it's there's a lot of gay people here, but everybody's getting priced out.
That's the problem. That's what I don't like. Now, I am in a rent-controlled apartment. I've lived in it for 30 years around the corner, and at some point maybe we have a lottery system, if you know how it works here for affordable housing.
I do not know how it works.
Well, San Francisco.
Do we have time for that?
Yeah, it's a long story, but San Francisco is going through, in my opinion, it's not a particularly good direction. It started many years ago with one of our former mayors, and Willie Brown, and making deals with developers and all that. And that's why we have all this building. They're building condos and expensive, and then of course the .com, and then the tech industry, and Twitter's right down the block, and Google, and all of that is here, Apple, it's all around. And that has changed the dynamics of the city. And yes, it's affected gay communities and the gay population. Mm-hmm. And a lot of my friends have moved to Palm Springs and they've left because it's just too expensive here, because Palm Springs is getting expensive too. It never used to be back there. Back in the 70s, you could buy, a Victorian in the Castro for, $20,000 or something. No, you really could if you were smart enough to do it then.
Yeah.
And now it's just because of the .com and the tech. I personally blame the tech industry. Because the city made all these deals. The city with Twitter, for example, which is right down on Market Street, a couple blocks from here.
Saw the headquarters yesterday.
The city made deals where, sure, come, bring your headquarters here, bring all your people here. We're not going to worry about building housing for them. We're going to give you a $54 million tax break to come here. So what's that all about? It doesn't help the city, and it certainly doesn't help the communities in the city, like the Mission. Mm-hmm. The Mission is the Latino section of the city. It always has been an affordable, wonderful neighborhood. Now it's Zuckerberg has a house there, you know, it's Facebook. It's all booming. And the Castro is, let's say, it's a gay-themed neighborhood. You can't afford to live there.
Yeah.
You can't even afford to have lunch there anymore. So that's something I don't like to see, and I don't know whether that's going to ever reverse itself in the future, especially in a place like San Francisco or New York.
It makes me curious to see, like, where young people like me are going to end up going to, because they're trying to find that kind of epicenter.
You know, I wouldn't know. I'd love if you find the answer to that.
Sometimes I go on these, I'd call them Googling whatevers. Like, I'll go on a, sorry, this echoiness is distracting me. I ended up Googling one night. I was trying to find out where the, like, cheap gay places to live were. Googling it. I didn't really find much information. And
you won't find very much if you Google.
You got to hear from word of mouth.
Gay retirements, either retirement communities. That is of concern to me and people of my generation. That's why I wanted to help build housing. And I mean, this is a drop in the bucket for what's needed here.
Yeah.
But other cities, fortunately, are working on it. LA and Chicago specifically are young gay senior housing.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I would love to know.
When I figure it out,
please do. I should give you my contact.
Yeah, I was going to give you my mailing address.
Oh, please do. Yes, and if you ever want to come and hang out here, I'd be happy to show you around.
I would love that.
Have you met Marcy?
I don't think so.
She's not here today, but Marcy Edelman is the founder of Open House, and her partner has passed away several years ago, and. Marcy, she's well connected in town, so she knows all the lesbians in town. She's wonderful and she's great. She got this built. It originally started as Rainbow Housing in 1998.
Rainbow Housing,
she and her partner, who's passed away, she's gone now for several years, they were farsighted. She's a psychotherapist. And she has a PhD, and she foresaw the need coming down the line for what do we do with gay seniors? And for my generation, when I was, this was a little different for me because I grew up in New York, and I actually always gravitated towards people who were older than me because I knew they had something to tell me. They had something to share with me, you know? And so I always kind of sought out somebody who was a little bit older. Now that I am older, you know? But that was kind of important to do that and seek out somebody who was a little older. So I'd be happy to show you
around. That's kind of funny to me because I spend so much time with my grandparents.
Yeah.
So not really a little bit older than me, but like a lot older. I see them every week. I take the bus into town to go visit them because they live about 30 minutes away from my college, and I have dinner with them every Friday.
That is wonderful, and you so proud to hear that, as I did too, because. In my generation, gay people as they aged were pushed back in the shadows.
Mm-hmm.
You were invisible again. You were not part of the gay community. And that really bothered me as I started to, not so much in my 40s, but as I got in my 50s, I could see, you know, that there was a need for, where do seniors go?
Yeah.
Now, before my generation, everybody was in the shadows of the closet. And you really, but as you got older, you were pushed kind of back in the closet. And that, I give Marcy, for example, a lot of credit and many others, because they said, no, we're going to build gay senior housing and we're going to march in the parade as gay seniors.
Yeah.
And they do, we do. And all of that. And that really wasn't the case back then. You know, back decades ago, and I always thought that older people, and they had so much to offer and to give, and they instructed me a lot. I think I mentioned previously, I told you about, you know, Bob Ross and Jose mm-hmm. Sierra and all of that, and I learned a lot from them about the Emperor and Empress, but I also, back in the day when Folsom, because I'm an old leather queen, I had mentors. Mm-hmm. I had mentors who instructed me, you know, what it meant and how to navigate that community. So older people, yeah. You know, don't shy away because it's.
Well, like as I told you before, there's not that. I don't know that many older gay people. They're not around in my communities. I'd say that it's really neat being on this trip with Sumi and Gail because they're so cool. I love them so much, and good. It's funny because Sumi will be very she'll say something in a very academic way that kind of puts things lightly, and then Gail will tell it how it is, and they work together really well. They're two peas in a pod.
Cool. Really
so
nice.
It's like really neat seeing that. And I had two high school teachers who were gay. They were both lesbians. But one I really thought was boring as heck. Gay and boring. She was the guitar teacher, and I played the guitar. I don't think she's a good guitarist, but... Anyways.
Express your creativity.
But not you, Miss Told. You're bored. I'm just kidding.
No.
But, and then there was Mrs. Moore, and she was the... she was the government teacher, and she was the person that was in charge of... We had a gay org, but technically speaking, it was lumped together with all the other cultural orgs.
Yeah, we didn't have anything like
that. Yeah, at least we had a gay org.
Gay organization, though.
It was a combination of, a Black Lives Matter org and also Hispanic and Chinese.
Marginalized
and
basically, communities that were...
We called it Diversity Club.
That's
and
something.
we had four people. most of them were closeted folks, but it was better than nothing, and it was nice to have that kind of figure. But I never really talked to her about.
Do you feel you have a platform now to be able to pursue your life and your life's dreams as an open lesbian? I think one of my questions to you before was, to what extent do you self-identify as gay?
Yeah.
And back in my day, it was really important for us to figure out who we were as gay people and in a gay community. Maybe it's not that important anymore for younger people because they think of careers and they think of family or they think of other things before they think of, yes, I'm gay. This is how I approach the world.
Well, one thing the more I learn about that, I've always been I'm proud of my gay identity and
good.
I claim it. And as I've been learning more about this history and more about the people in my community, the more proud I am to claim that identity. Wait, what was the other part of your question? I forgot.
Well, we have talked also about adultism, and I'm so glad that you. Because that's an interesting thing within the gay community.
Mm-hmm.
And I mentioned when I was with the HRC, we did the town hall on
uh-huh.
intergenerational connections and how to bridge the gap. And
how to bridge the gap.
There are organizations here like Frameline, if you mm-hmm. know who Frameline is. Frameline does the LGBT Film Festival every
mm-hmm.
June during the parade, and they are a large organization and they do LGBT films. And they have a program that's been up and running for many years where they pair an older and a younger person
mm-hmm.
and they make films together.
Oh, that's cool.
It's very cool. And there are a lot of that, I don't want to say a lot, but there's things
they're
like
there.
That out there.
More than there would be in other places.
Right. As a matter of fact, just
yeah.
a few weeks ago, right in that very room, through Open House,
uh-huh.
I took a class on LGBT playwrights. Uh-huh. Well, it was a 7-week seminar. LGBT playwrights. So we did Tennessee Williams, William Inge, Edward Albee, Lorraine Hansberry, Lillian Hellman, Cole Porter, Stephen Sondheim, and that's great, you know. So there's and young and old, you know, it could be connection,
wow.
you know,
wow.
younger people who are interested in theater and want a little
mm-hmm.
gay people who want a little history and knowledge of these playwrights, for example.
Well, one thing I know, one thing that comes to mind at the moment is, so I'm in this really gay community. I'm at Mount Holyoke. There's all these lesbians, and then there's all these everything in between, and it's all good. And
yeah.
But the thing is, we don't know our history. It's not being not everybody has the opportunity to take a college course on it, And when I was trying to figure out what I was going to do to research it, I had to go on this wild goose chase to figure out where to start.
Really?
And because like I was like, where do you start? So I actually started out by looking at a Wikipedia page and then looking at the sources, the most common books, and then I'd look at the books that those books would reference, and I'd be like, oh gosh, this spider web of books, and I'm like, ah.
Go to the Castro branch of the main library here. And
they have
tons of gay literature and gay history. No, seriously.
I
believe you come back, I'll definitely take you there. Uh-huh. Yeah, the Castro branch, the Eureka Valley branch is where Castro was, Eureka Valley. That's the whole gay section.
It's funny because once I finally got going, it's like it was a whole nother world where I found all these information. I found the gay section in my library, and it made things a lot easier.
The main library down here has the James Hormel room, which is, if you know who James Hormel is.
I don't.
He is he's a gay man. He's well up in his 80s now or so, but he was an ambassador in the government. I'm going to forget where now. But anyway, he has a government service.
Uh-huh.
And so they named the room after him at the main library downtown in Civic Center. Uh-huh. And there's a huge collection there of LGBT historical books and whatnot.
This kind of reminds me of something. It's a little fun fact. My cousin just had a baby. I consider myself the aunt to the baby, but I was at the bookstore in the Castro. There's a bookstore there. And
yeah,
I was looking at
books?
The children's books.
Dog aid books.
I was gonna get one of the really like the gay friendly children's books for the kid when it grows up, so I can be that aunt. I was gonna also get the A for activism book.
There you go. Well, you know, activism is important, and every generation will have its moments where they need to. Well, with Trump, you're definitely going to have.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what I mean. I'm concerned about passing the
I just don't even know where to start with him because it just feels. It feels like, you know, I've babysat a few times in my life, and it feels like, you know, you take the stick away that they're trying to eat, they go and accidentally run off a cliff. You know, it feels kind of like every single time we try and do something, it turns out he's distracting us.
Oh, that's his MO.
It's his thing. It's a
distraction. It's an entertainer.
It's
like, look over here.
These distractions are like so harmful too. So I try and like take it with a grain of salt, and I try and like look at the news not more than four times.
That's a good thing. I watch Rachel Maddow every night, but I can't watch the whole thing because she's wonderful. If it's a particular story I need to, you know, really get into, but when things come out so fast, I just want. Okay, this is something I don't need to worry about right now. This is something that will pass. This is something I'm more scared about Pence, to tell you the truth.
Oh, yeah, actually.
So we have a lot to worry about.
He's not a dumbass. Like, he knows how to operate within the government, whereas he's not the yellow-headed buffoon that, like, with the weird hair. Like,
well, he's an entertainer. He's running the Trump is like an running this like a reality show.
Yeah.
And he knows it. Pence. And this is based on an article I read in the New Yorker and some research that I've done. He's not a very bright person.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't bright in school or any of that.
Yes.
He has Republican money behind him. He worked for the Heritage Foundation, whatever. And it was the Koch brothers and the Republican money that said, okay, you put him on as your vice president.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a larger plan in works behind the scenes. It's not just Trump, it's the Republicans with the money and their positioning. They tried to do it with the gerrymandering, with the, you know, the redistricting and everything. That may be backfiring on them, I hope, but so we'll see what happens. But that's in your lap now.
I'm aware of that.
In your lap. We had Anita Bryant, and we had Briggs, and we had Dan White, and we had, you know.
And now it's our turn. Yeah. Oh, boy.
Well, the way I look at it now in terms of history, I know there's not a lot that I can do anymore. My days of marching in the street. I mean, I'm still out there being an activist, doing what I can. But, for example, one way to do it is I have two cousins, my cousins Renee and my cousin Ginny, and I grew up with them. They're like sisters. And Renee has a gay grandson, and Ginny has a lesbian daughter who's doing her PhD in University of Edinburgh, as a matter of fact. And I am like, they both look to me Christine's been out here, and I've taken her down to Castro in 18th, and said, this is the epicenter, this is mm-hmm. where it all happened, right here. It's where communities were built, it's where communities were torn down, it's where riots happened, it's where community celebrations happened, it's mm-hmm. all happened here. And so I felt really good, because she was really thrilled to get that little bit of a history lesson.
Yeah.
And so I feel I'm...
You're helping
what I can
that
do
next
now
generation
is,
by setting these people up
right.
with the information.
To just do what I can.
Yeah.
I'm not marching in the streets so much anymore. I've been out there doing a couple of resist rallies and things like that. But
it makes me think about like the different ways to do activism. And like that's something I've been thinking about on our campus.